KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Baron Silka, who, among other things, is the co-editor of the book The Next Digital Decade, Essays on the Future of the Internet. And Baron and this Baron and his co-editor, Adam Marcus, who is not joining us on the show today, put together a stellar list of authors who have offered a number of essays covering what Baron has identified as 10 key questions in the world of technology policy. And as you go down the list of the people who he got for this book, it's a not only a great list, it's a list of whom many have been on Hearsay Culture, among them including Jonathan Zittrain, Ann Bartow, Eric Goldman, Tim Wu, and a variety of other people, Larry Downs, Frank Pasquale, James Grimmelman. So it's a terrific collection. And what he's done in this book is pose a number of questions that frame the essays, and we're going to spend time on some of those questions today. The Baron's background is a very interesting one, and it's one that feeds into the discussion we're going to have today. Prior to founding the organization Tech Freedom that he will talk about, he was a senior fellow and the director of the Center for Internet Freedom at the Progress and Freedom Foundation, which was one of the early technology policy think tanks in Washington, and certainly the first one that I can think of that focused heavily on market power and competition as a basis for forming internet and technology policy. Before joining the Progress and Freedom Foundation, he was an associate in the communications practice group at Latham & Watkins. He has authored articles. He got his economics degree from Duke and his JD from Virginia, and he's served in a variety of posts within the bar, and also, again, from a policy perspective, is well known as a blogger at the Technology Liberation Front blog, which is a blog that I read regularly. In fact, not only do I read it regularly, but I'll always pay attention to it for the books and authors that people at Technology Liberation Front are reading, because often those are great guests for Hearsay Culture. And I should also mention that Technology Liberation Front has done some interesting podcasts in the past on some of these issues. And so I'm very excited to have Baron on today to talk about not only his background, which is extensive in policymaking inside Washington and advocating on a variety of technology policy issues, but also on his perspectives on a variety of topics, primary, although not exclusively, primarily focusing on privacy, which is a particular interest of Baron's. But we're also going to talk about some interesting things, including why Baron would rather not spend much time talking about copyright, of all things, on Hearsay Culture, a topic that we focus on heavily. And so we're going to talk to Baron a bit about why, in fact, copyright is not something perhaps we need to spend some time on here. So I'm very excited to have Baron on, whose work I've always found insightful and informative, and therefore, without any further, he is joining us from Washington, D.C. via Skype, recording on July 16th. Baron, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start off with a question I ask most of my guests that I have on, and I think it's an interesting question for you, Baron, particularly given your background. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you became interested, particularly in technology policy issues, and perhaps a bit about how you formed your perspective on them.
Well, actually, that's a great segue into the book. So the book, which I want to start by mentioning, is a free ebook that's available for download at nextdigitaldecade.com, but also in all good e-book stores. In the introduction for those 31 essays that you mentioned, I answer this question, and I explain that really this book brings me personally back full circle to why I got into this field, which was as a freshman in college in the fall of 1998, reading a book called The Future and Its Enemies by Virginia Postrel, which really shaped my thinking in this more than anything else. And you'll see that theme comes out in the book itself, and we can unpack that. But in a nutshell, Virginia argued that the really important divide in policy debates going forward, and especially in technology policy, but really in all areas, is not really between left and right, or even necessarily about the size of the state and the role of the state. So it's not libertarianism and the state or conservatism or anything else like that, but two mentalities. One is the stasis mentality, which seeks to preserve the status quo and to change slowly and to manage change. And that falls into really two groups, the reactionaries who want to stop change as much as they can, and the technocrats who love the future and love technology but think that they can manage it and steer it in better directions. So those two groups are just different representations of the stasis mentality. And on the other hand, there is a wide range of people who have different opinions about the role of the state. Some of them may be libertarians, some of them are more social democrats or progressives. But what unites them is what she broadly calls dynamism, or in some places evolutionary dynamism. And that mentality has always guided me, and it's the thing that, in a very concrete way, is why we at Tech Freedom end up finding ourselves in what might seem like odd bedfellows pairings on issues like SOPA, and why you see members of Congress in rather odd pairings, because they're uniting across party lines because they share, although they may not realize it, they share this common belief that ultimately technological change is something that is difficult to predict. It is itself a great disciplining agent for corporate power. In that sense, a great protector of the individual against the abuses of whether it's monopolies or some particular problem that people worry about, like privacy. In other words, to put it, I think, in the simplest form, one might say, in change we trust. And that's not to say that technological change is always good, because it's certainly not. But that the, well, I often paraphrase one of my favorite lines from The Simpsons here, where Homer says, alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems. I think much the same thing can be said for technological change. It is the cause of and solution to all of life's problems, but on the whole, the overall trajectory is a positive one. And so you see that theme expressed in the introduction to the next digital decade, and it's something that many of the authors respond to.
Now, to connect, that perspective to your current activity, I think it's important. It gives, I think, the listeners a good sense of where you're coming from. Tell us a bit about Tech Freedom and your founding of it, and particularly the goals of Tech Freedom.
Sure. Well, so we're a small technology policy think tank. When people ask us how to describe us, or if they want a byline or some short description when I'm quoted in a story, they often, it's interesting to see what words they choose. Sometimes they use the word conservative, which surprises me. Sometimes they want to use the word libertarian, and I personally would self-describe as a libertarian. But I think the word that best describes us is really Virginia Postrel's word. It's that we're a dynamist think tank. And the only reason I don't use that word more widely is that I don't think people have the full context behind it. And so, just as an aside here, actually, one of my projects for the next year and a half is trying to revive that word and ideally writing a book about dynamism, although we'll see where that goes. But the 15th anniversary of that book is coming up in December of 2013, so I'd like to do what I can to revive that. So that's sort of our mission, which is, in a nutshell, I often cite the line that comes from the Supreme Court's decision in U.S. v. Playboy back in 2000, where Justice Kennedy says in really truly beautiful prose that technology expands individual capacity to choose, and it denies the potential of the digital revolution if we presume that government is best positioned to make choices for us. And so in a nutshell, our belief is, on the one hand, that technology ultimately does empower the individual, and also that the presumption should really be first do no harm for policymakers. And that's not to say that I don't think there's a role for government at all, but that the general premise that we start with is that we shouldn't meddle until there's a clearly demonstrated problem and a role for government. And before we get back to the book, I would just say that if anyone wants a very short summary of our views, I think you could do no better than to go look at the alternative declaration of internet freedom that we issued along with a number of other dynamist free market or market-oriented groups, which is at declarationofinternetfreedom.org. And that differs, I think, pretty significantly from the other Declaration of Internet Freedom that your listeners might have heard more about. But the two things I would just call to your attention there that I think answer your question about our substantive views are that we, before we get into specific policy areas like free expression and innovation, we open with two general principles, which are first and foremost humility, which is to say, first, do no harm, that no one can anticipate the future, and that government's response is often to do nothing, and that competition, technological disruption, and indeed criticism from civil society tend to resolve problems better and faster than government can. So when we talk about market forces working, we think all of those are part of that reaction. So I find it a little strange when people think of us as just somehow believing simplistically that corporations can do no wrong and that they will always protect users. I actually tend to agree with Adam Smith when he said that seldom do men of the same trade gather for mirth and merriment, but that their conversation turns to a conspiracy as to how to oppress the consumer. Which is to say, I don't doubt that everyone is out there to maximize their short-term interests, and that often means that people try to screw the consumer. But my worldview really is not about intentions, it's about results. And that really, in a nutshell, was the whole point of the invisible hand, that people, even when they intend to be greedy or malicious, are guided to do things that serve the common interest. And I think that's nowhere more true than in the area of the internet, because technology is changing at a pace that that ensures that no one stays on top for long. So the concerns that people have in the rest of the economy, you know, we might disagree about how aggressive antitrust enforcement should be or the larger need for government intervention. But I think it is possible for people to be internet exceptionalists, which is one of the topics in the next digital decade, which is to say that they can look at the internet and at areas of high tech differently than they would see other areas of the economy. And in that area, be more, if you want to use the word libertarian, but I would just say more in general that they're more dynamists, and they believe that government should start small and should be very careful in intervening. And there's just one passage in the book that I just commend to all of you, where Virginia Postrel, writing in 1998, quotes Mike Godwin, who was at the Electronic Frontier Foundation at the time, and says that it is easier to learn from the past than it is from the future. And it's for that reason that the legal principles and rules we already have tend to work better in addressing the policy challenges of tomorrow than complicated new regimes. And that's why, more than anything else, what we do at Tech Freedom is to engage in policy debates and policy fights by advocating a preference for example, dealing with net neutrality, not on the basis of crafting an entirely new regulatory regime, but asking how we can use well-understood principles like the consumer welfare standard of antitrust law to deal with real problems when they arise. So that in a nutshell is our approach, and we take that at Tech Freedom across a wide range of tech policy issues, everything from the fight about SOPA we were very involved in to leading the charge to protect citizens against government intrusions in their privacy, to at the same time arguing that when it comes to the private sector's use of data, we need to be a little careful not to disrupt the basic ingredient of the digital ecosystem by over-regulating in advance of a clear problem. And we also cover antitrust, free speech, child protection. We do amicus briefs from time to time. We're doing one now in the net neutrality case, and we've done a number in the past few years. And I would just close this particular question by saying that we tend to have natural allies on some issues among groups that would self-describe as being market-oriented, but we also work very closely with groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Center for Democracy and Technology, and even many groups like the ACLU, the Constitution Project, and on occasion, even groups like the Electronic Privacy Information Center. So those are all groups that we disagree with on some issues, but we make common cause with them where we can, and that tends to be where the issue is limiting government intrusions or access to information.
Yeah, you mentioned the idea of thinking about industries differently and cyberspace exceptionalism, which is for at least sort of technology, law, and policy, the age-old question of whether technology and the internet are different such that we need different laws. But I'm curious, you mentioned being perplexed by some of the labels that you've received, and certainly in recent years with the financial debacle that the country faces, the idea of deregulation has been under attack. You may disagree with that critique that lack of regulation in the finance industry, caused many of the problems that we face now. But let's assume, just for purposes of this question, I'm not asking you to agree with it, and certainly I don't want to go down that path. But I want to use it by comparison to technology. How is it, assuming that critique is accurate, and perhaps that's not something you want to assume, but for purposes of my question, assume that that's an accurate critique. What makes technology different such that a pushback on your view saying, well, look at how deregulation or the lack of an active government role impacted the finance industry, and therefore we should not treat the internet the same way? What would be your response to that pushback, to that comparison, if you will?
So I think it's an astute question. It's one I've gotten many times. And I would say in response to that I think both the internet and the financial sector are unique in their own ways. That is to say that they are fundamentally different from other policy questions. And what I mean by that, I think you've heard a little bit about why I think that's the case for the internet. And then that is fundamentally, to make this really simple, Moore's Law, if you want to pick one particular way of looking at this, really means that this area is characterized by disruptive change in a way that no other area of the economy is. And in that regard, I would say that the other book that shaped my thinking in this area, and I would encourage everyone else to read, even though it is by no means a policy book, it's how I think about industry, is Clayton Christensen's 1998 book, The Innovator's Dilemma. And I think that book stands in very, very close pairing with Virginia Postrel's The Future and Its Enemies, and also more recently with my colleague Larry Downs, who's an adjunct at Tech Freedom, has a wonderful book that came out in 2009 called The Laws of Disruption, which really, in a sense, picks up on the theme that both he and Clayton Christensen were working on in the late 1990s in their business writing about the killer app, which was Larry's concept, and The Innovator's Dilemma, which was Clayton's, and about what that means for policy. So that's where I think the internet is different and where technology changes things. But without getting into too much detail about the financial sector,
right,
I think it's also true that the financial sector is different, because if there's one sort of overarching analog there to Moore's Law, it is the fact that everything in that sector is shaped by government. So behind financial regulatory policy is monetary policy. And people, they don't tend to think about that. But in a way, these are like mirror, to me, they're mirror images of each other. So on the one hand, the financial sector is one that is totally distorted by the Federal Reserve and by monetary policy. And then people tend to blame the market when the whole system goes crazy. Anyway, this is a way of saying that I think actually one could, in good conscience, take any range of positions on normal policy issues, and at the same time think that the financial sector is completely screwed up, and that what happened was a mix of government in some areas under regulation, in some areas over regulation, and more fundamentally that monetary policy played a huge role there. And yet, when it comes to the internet, again, whatever your views are on healthcare, for instance, I think you can line up along what I would describe as a coalition of dynamism, which says that the internet the term internet exceptionalism has several different meanings. And I think if I would recommend to your listeners one chapter in the book as background on tech policy, it would be the chapter and the essays that are in there about internet exceptionalism, mm-hmm. which really explain that there have been several waves, and this is Eric Goldman's contribution to the debate in saying that the 1996 Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace that John Perry Barlow wrote is a beautiful document. I think there's much in there that I still agree with today, but his particular formulation of internet exceptionalism is not necessarily what I'm talking about here. It was sort of, it was the most aggressive form. It basically said the internet is completely different. Government cannot be effective here. They cannot do anything. And basically they should just go away. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, clearly as a descriptive matter is wrong. Tim Wu, is completely right, when he and Jack Goldsmith wrote in 2006 that, physicality persists, that it is still possible for governments to discipline individuals and to regulate the internet by, just for example, to take the discussion about SOPA, they can go after payment systems. There are still points of control that governments can exercise. And it's possible that things like Bitcoin, if they were ever successful, could change that analysis. But to make this really simple, I would just say that my own view is not that extreme internet exceptionalism. It is rather to say that the internet is different and exceptional insofar as one can be much more confident that technological change will ultimately protect consumers and discipline corporations than in the rest of the economy. And for that reason, one could, as I do, one could believe in a first do no harm rule for policymakers and for a general stance of humility and a preference for letting that complex mix of technological change and criticism of companies and other factors play out before assuming that government regulation is the answer. You could take that view and still think whatever you want to about healthcare and something maybe entirely more radical about the financial sector. But it's a good question. It's one that really comes up a lot.
We're chatting with Baron Soka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the book The Next Digital Decade, Essays on the Future of the Internet on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Baron, let's play off that a little bit more. I mean, I think it's so critical to, your perspective, but also to how you structured the book, that I want to ask one more follow-up question with regard to that issue. So, as you mentioned, and I agree with you, I think the essays you have on this topic are terrific, and Eric's work in particular has influenced me. Not only when I teach internet law and talk about cyberspace exceptionalism, but more broadly, because Eric's perspective is certainly one coming from having worked at ePinions and being very focused on market forces and technology and trademark and advertising and so forth. You, and commendably, you bring in authors that have a variety of perspectives on these topics, including viewpoints that are, I think, as close to diametrically opposed to yours as possible, including Frank Pasquale, who I'm venturing to say, if I were to think of what would be the opposite in terms of worldview of Baron Soka, it would be Frank, knowing his work as I do. And Frank, writes in the book this fundamental concern about a lack of a strong government role in policymaking. And I just want to ask you about that, particularly with reference to his essay. But to put it simply, although I think accurately, Frank's general concern, and he's written about this in the context of advocating that search engines be regulated by a federal agency and that policies be written around how to make sure that search and search engines accurately and fairly produce results for consumers. So he talks about, he is part of the group of people that have really developed the law of search engines and regulating search. Long-winded way of saying, I think if Frank were here, Frank would say, well, Baron, that's all well and good, but unless we have a strong government role, particularly in technology, corporations and their incentives are going to corrupt what we have. And I guess my question for you really is how far do you think that criticism goes? I mean, this is a segue into privacy issues, right? But if you have an entity like Facebook who tinkers with their policies on a fairly regular basis, and clearly their goal is not to maintain the privacy of individuals, but they need to so long as people are going to use it. Is that your response, or how would you push back or respond to that general criticism that left to their own devices, we're just going to have corporate control of everything?
Well, first, let me say thank you for noting the diversity of the book. This is really not an advocacy piece.
No, I think it's a terrific list.
And I really went out of my way to present a collection of material that I thought would be a good introduction for someone who was interested in tech policy. It's a long book. It's 575 pages, so it's quite hefty. But it's, you know, not a novel. You don't have to read it cover to cover. You can pick out the essays that are of interest to you. And I really bent over backwards, as you say, to get everyone in there that I could to take each side or multiple takes on each of these 10 questions. And Frank is a great example. Frank has two essays in the book. Frank is one of my very favorite technocrats, but a technocrat he certainly is. He's someone who loves technology, and as Adam Thier, my former colleague at the Progress and Freedom Foundation, describes in his essay at the beginning of the book, Frank is a good example of a net lover who really truly loves technology. He's by no means a Luddite. I don't want to dismiss him as that at all. But he is fundamentally a pessimist about what happens if, as you say at the end of your question, if technology is left to itself. And so I think if you want to understand what I think is the after you get through the dynamist stasis paradigm, what I think is the major question in technology policy, it is essentially that for the last 15 years, we have been in dialogue with Larry Lessig's prediction in Code that left to itself, and I'm quoting here, left to itself, cyberspace will not fulfill the promise of freedom. Cyberspace will become a perfect tool of control, right? That, in a nutshell, is the technocratic fear of technological change. And ultimately, that's why the technocrats think that cyberspace can't be left to itself. It has to be steered by government regulations, such as you mentioned, Frank's proposal for a federal search commission or for some other way of ensuring that search algorithms are appropriate. But the same thing is true for net neutrality regulation. The same thing is true for calls for comprehensive baseline federal privacy legislation, as well as for more detailed ideas like a mandated right to be forgotten. So the alternative to those things, right, is not we just do nothing and we just assume that that everything will just work out fine. But to really get back to Lessig, it's this idea, so he says left to itself, technology will become a tool of perfect control. Well, my first response is I don't think that technology is ever left to itself. I think that there are always a complex array of forces that are working. We've already mentioned them. So it's that array of technological change itself, which is a great disruptive force, but also one that I think serves to protect consumers and to discipline the very what Tim Wu calls the information empires or gatekeepers or bottleneck holders. But also competition. Even when competition doesn't seem to exist today in a you know, straight head-to-head fashion. So, for example, Google and Bing, you know, people might dismiss that as saying, well, hey, that market's not competitive. But as Joseph Schumpeter argued, 80 years ago, competition in these markets is not necessarily between the number one player and number two player today. It's between today's number one player and tomorrow's who knows what. Mm-hmm. So, it, for example, is the fact that Facebook is, I'm sure, out there working on their own search technology, and that's something that could fundamentally change the paradigm of search, as it's been changed many times before, just as Apple's Siri is doing that. I have no idea how that's going to work out, but that, I think, tends to protect consumers. But ultimately, this is where the rubber really hits the road, is what's the role for government? And their approach, in a nutshell, is... whereas I say first do no harm to regulators, they often say, at least on some issues, first do something. It's like the old joke, don't just stand there, do something, right?
Right.
And I don't think I'm being unfair when I say that, because certainly these groups would tend to agree with us that we should do no harm in some areas, like free speech, they're great on, for the most part. But I'll take just the example of privacy. I think that's a really good example. How do you deal with the problem that corporations may indeed abuse data about users? I am not at all blind to that problem, although I think it's worth pointing out that, as James Grimmelman does, hardly libertarian,
yeah.
that most of those problems are actually what he calls peer-to-peer. They're about users saying things about each other. They're problems that are very difficult for the law to deal with. But there are certainly other problems that are not peer-to-peer that have to do with how companies deal with users. And I just gave Senate testimony about this that I think has been the best summary of my views thus far. And in a nutshell, my point is that to those that say that we don't have a baseline for privacy in this country, I respond by saying that we do. We have a baseline of consumer protection. We've had that since the 1930s. It is the Federal Trade Commission's standards of unfairness and deception. And I'm often, I get, you know, rolls of the eyes when I mention that, because there are a lot of people who think that the FTC is toothless and that all they can do is enforce promises that companies make once they make them. And so how does that really protect us? And as I explained in my testimony, and I think you see some of this come out in the book too, I actually think that that model really has not been used, not only not fully, but I don't think it's been used particularly well at all. And without getting into too much detail, I would just say that that model, at its best, is a sort of quasi-common law. It's a way of developing on a case-by-case basis what Richard Epstein, the great legal scholar, called simple rules for a complex world, which is to say you start with simple doctrines and you apply them as technology changes. The problem is that model really, it hasn't been used as a common law because companies never litigate, ever. There are no privacy litigations in this area that I'm aware of. And they don't because of the PR risks are enormous, which to me actually says that the reputation markets work quite well here. Mm-hmm. They make companies extremely averse to bad press. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, because the FTC never litigates, it's ultimately incumbent on the FTC itself to build doctrine. In other words, when they bring a complaint and then they settle the consent decree, they say, well, this company did X, Y, and Z. We allege that this is unfair or deceptive. And then in a few sentences, they say what they think is the harm to consumers if we're talking about unfairness. They say there are no countervailing benefits and it can't be avoided reasonably by consumers. And those are the three prongs of the FTC's unfairness doctrine. But they don't actually explain that. And so my argument in a nutshell, I think this is just a good example of the larger point here, is that we have those, as Mike Godwin put it, we have those well-established legal principles and standards, but if we don't actually use them, if we don't explain them, of course they're not going to be very effective. But my preference would be that we start by asking, how can we make the FTC more effective in building that sort of quasi-common law? Do they need more resources? I'm someone who generally wants government to be significantly smaller, but I would also think that it's penny wise, pound foolish not to give the FTC the resources that it needs to explain itself in its litigation, and that ultimately the right measure of its success is not how many cases it brings, but rather how well it builds those doctrines over time to allow us to have predictability. So that if I'm an innovator and I'm pushing the boundaries on sharing, that I can actually look at the doctrine and understand what might be allowed in the future. So that's just an example of the approach that a dynamist would take. It's an evolutionary approach, and it says that we should, you know, build law over time. So if you want to make this really simple, the debate in a way is between that sort of organic evolutionary conception of law, which starts from simple principles and works itself over time, preferably through the courts, but it could be done by the agencies. So that's sort of my model. That's what the dynamists generally want, although sometimes there's room for legislation, and sometimes it's based on legislation. And then the technocrats, people like Frank, they don't see the majesty of that. They will dismiss that, as Senator Rockefeller recently told me in my Senate testimony. He dismissed that as complex legal machinations.
I was going to say, as soon as you said Rockefeller, I was going to say, okay.
Well, yeah. I won't get into it here, but I'll just say, if any of you want a fun example of the stasis mentality work, you should go watch that hearing and my interaction with him, and start at, I think, 61 minutes in.
And what you said, what hearing was it?
This was the Senate Commerce Committee hearing which bore the loaded question, is privacy : is self-regulation enough? And of course my answer was, no, of course it's not. Nobody's saying it is. What I'm saying is that there's a complex array of other forces at work here, like the forces that drive companies to limit their own behavior and to enter into codes of conduct. But the point is, for someone like him, unless he sees a complex set of regulations built up in a way that seems to be complete, comprehensive, baseline, he's not going to be satisfied. And so my point in a nutshell is that same debate has played out in competition and net neutrality and privacy, even in copyright, in many other areas of the law here. And that's ultimately what I'm arguing for. And that sort of dynamism is... It permits a wide range of opinions. I mean, you could agree with me and think that the FTC should be very aggressive in that framework. And we might disagree about that. Similarly, you might think that the standards for antitrust intervention should be relatively low. And I might think they should be relatively high. But at least if we agree that that was the better way to look at these problems, we'd be working in the same framework. And that, in a nutshell, is my mission. You see a lot of that come out in this book in the next digital decade, but it's something that I'm hoping to tease out in that future book I hinted at, if indeed I can find the time to write that.
Well, I think it's something that I will save for a future show, inviting you back down the road for further discussion. You're listening to KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you who listen regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of what you do, I hope that you continue to listen to Hearsay Culture as well as to the station. So, Baron, we have about 18 minutes or so left, 17, 18 minutes, and I do want to turn to something I mentioned in the introduction. A regular topic of discussion on Hearsay Culture is copyright law, and you make a specific point that I want to talk to you about, at least for a few minutes, that you feel that copyright is a bit overdone, if you will. What's your perspective on copyright law in terms of the focus that policymakers and scholars have on technology policy broadly?
I think it tends to suck up all the oxygen in the room. It's a sexy issue. I think this field is fundamentally shaped by the fact that when most of the people many of the people who get into it, many of them are law students. They're exposed to Larry Lessig's work, particularly code, and they take away from that the idea that the technology policy is really a debate about copyright fundamentally. And they just, I can't tell you how many applicants for summer fellowships I get that say copyright's what brought them into this, copyright's what they want to do, and that's really their entire vision. And I think it's unfortunate. I think it blinds people to the wide range of other really important issues in this field.
Let me interrupt you quickly. What are those other areas you think are being neglected?
Well, so the first among them is the conversation we've been having, which is the meta conversation about technology policy. Internet exceptionalism, dynamism, stasism, the poise for regulators, how they look at the internet, those are things. This to me is the real conversation that happened about SOPA. SOPA to me is not really about copyright. I mean, that was the flashpoint, but fundamentally it was how should policymakers approach the internet? Mm-hmm. What should their default presumption be? What are the burdens that the government should bear for having to justify intervention? What should the process look like? How deliberative should it be? What is the role for expertise mm-hmm. in informing policymakers? So that to me is the big question that doesn't get attention precisely because it seems so amorphous. And we can talk about that more, but mm-hmm. going from that, I would say at the top of the list for me is the question of, we're talking about the information economy, ultimately. It's the flow of information and data. And to me, the old fights in the 90s were about the traditional forms of censorship, things like the Communications Decency Act of 1996, the Child Online Protection Act, COPPA, of 1998. And today, I think the fights that we're having in that regard are really about privacy, which is to say, really, it's about use restrictions on the collection, use, and processing of data, some of which may be justified, but I think in general they're forms of censorship. And we should look at them as such and decide when they're warranted. So that's the big thing. Section 230, which is the one provision of the Communications Decency Act of 1996 that survives. It is, I think, the bedrock of internet freedom, if there is one in this country, in addition to the First Amendment. And it is, in essence, the law that says that online intermediaries don't have a legal responsibility for the speech that their users offer. And they're not responsible for censoring it, for cleaning it up. They can if they want to, but they won't incur legal responsibility for doing so. That general theme of what should intermediaries be responsible for doing, that's one of the other big questions here that I think doesn't get nearly enough attention. And that's a question that crosses copyright. That was a large part of the debate in SOPA. What are the intermediaries responsible for doing? I mean, really, if you want to be simplistic about it, that really was the debate in SOPA. But that's a larger debate. That's true in privacy. It's true in speech. So what I'm trying to say is that there are these other themes of dynamism versus stasism, the role of government, the approach of government, the responsibility of intermediaries. Those span other particular issues, from online gambling to copyright to privacy to how you deal with DUI apps mm-hmm. on cell phones. And I think we'd all be a lot better off if we focused more on the meta themes, if you will, than the particular policy areas.
Yeah, it's interesting you have this point because, and again, I mean, without getting too far into the weeds of academia, there is a regular debate. It's not even a debate, really. Discussion about, in terms of scholarship, writing articles that are policy-oriented, which is a euphemism for practical, and suggesting that, you know, the government changed the law to say this, or this case was wrong because of that, versus what is, again, in this line drawing, theoretical, which are viewed as the articles that have more staying power and have more impact and what have you. And I think that at least is partially the reason why copyright has this allure to it, because it allows scholars to quickly dive into these very theoretical discussions about idea versus expression, and you know, what is a work of authorship and what is an author, and it does, I think, divert a lot of scholars away from looking at other issues, because, as you point out, and I think correctly, they appear more cut and dried, as well as amorphous. You know, I focus heavily over the last couple of years on these questions involving effectively, how should IP law be made? What kind of process should be there? And when I say, as I have repeatedly, that the process needs to be more open, that more information needs to be made available to the public so that experts can offer input, I think a lot of the response that I get is, well, of course. But it's not an of course scenario, which leads me to that follow-up question that I want to ask, and particularly given your experience in Washington. As you, and I'm not asking you to name names, although you're welcome to, as you have these discussions among policymakers, and copyright is so much of the fulcrum of the debate, do you think that policymakers generally are aware of these other issues? I mean, you mentioned, obviously, a Senate, you know, a Commerce Committee hearing on privacy, but in terms of the actual attention that policymakers are giving to technology issues, is it still, as it seems to be, a scenario where copyright is dominating that discussion as well?
Well, yes. I think it's not just copyright. I think the discussion is dominated by things. My colleague Jim Harper at Cato has this very funny way of saying, you know, that copyright or privacy is a thing. You can get your arms around it. It makes sense. It's a word. It's an abstraction. It makes a good title for a hearing. It's a good story. It's a thing. What people hear both in the policy world and particularly on the Hill have a hard time getting their arms around is these larger points about process and how law is made. And so just, you know, the analog to what you're describing about copyright is privacy. If you think about it, I really can't give you a more compelling example than this, that we have spent now 15 years arguing about online privacy and how to regulate it, and it has produced an endless stream of work about the fair information practice principles and what legislation should look like and how to instantiate them, et cetera, et cetera. And no one has ever really, with maybe very, very few exceptions, has never asked what I think are the much simpler questions of, all right, so what we have today is a system where we have state attorneys general, we have private lawsuits, we have the Federal Trade Commission, we have this layered approach, we have some legislation in particular areas. How effective is that, and how could it be made to work better? I just give you some examples. And I think this would show you the way that I look at the world. It's very different, which is like, okay, so the privacy torts for defamation, let's just say. People tend to think, well, those don't work. They're not effective. Well, how could they be more effective? I mean, for example, would it fundamentally change the calculus, or would it at least help on the margins if you were defamed online and if you could recover attorney's fees, right? That's just a question of statute. You could imagine changing those things on the state level to empower those who were defamed online. It's a simple example. The more basic one, just to come back to the FTC, is does the FTC have the resources it needs? Peter Swire, who gave testimony at that same hearing I did, and we're very much on opposite sides of these issues, we agree about a lot. I mean, he 5 years ago said the Federal Trade Commission needs to create an Office of Information Technology, the same way it has a Bureau of Economics, to build up an internal expertise to advise it mm-hmm. on the path of regulation. If the FTC had taken that step 5 years ago, instead of what, to his great credit, Chairman Leibowitz only 2 years ago, I think it was, finally hired one chief technology officer, right? So if we had done that 5 years ago, and if we had today an office of people behind him, I think we would have a much more capable and smarter regulator that was able to build effective common law. So that issue has gotten no attention. And neither has what I think are the really fundamental basic questions of, is the FTC effectively building doctrine today? I'm just astonished that no one has already done the work on those questions, and that it's up to someone like me to dig on that. And I think it really speaks to your point that there's a real fundamental bias in the academy, among law students, among policymakers, to focus on these. And the academy is these sort of, as you say, these conceptually interesting, high level, black and white questions. And then among policymakers, it's these abstractions. And they all sort of reduce to the same thing, which is you get people talking about what really turn out to be castles in the sky. You know, how could we design the perfect piece of legislation? What would it look like? And my for a whole variety of reasons, my approach in a nutshell is, how can we evolve, iterate, as people like to say in Silicon Valley, how can we iterate upon the model that we already have? And I think if we did that in areas like privacy, we would wind up with much better rules without some of the draconian consequences. So SOPA is just one example of a draconian piece of legislation that violates my fundamental rule of first do no harm and start small for regulators.
We're chatting with Baron Soka, co-editor of the book, The Next Digital Decade, Essays on the Future of the Internet. Baron, we have at this point, sadly, about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I do want to turn to ask you about these next projects that you've mentioned and more broadly about what you're working on now. So perhaps I'll just give you that open space in the next 3 minutes or so. Tell us a bit more about this book that you may do, but more specifically about what is currently occupying your time.
Well, the Next Digital Decade, the book we've been talking about, is intended to be an introduction. It's the sort of book that I myself would have wanted if I had been starting out in this field as I was 15 years ago. And so the next step for us is having done that, having brought together this really ecumenical array of authors in that free ebook, which again I encourage all of your listeners to download and share, and if you teach a class to consider assigning to your students. Mm-hmm. Moving forward, what I really want to do, what interests me most now, is developing the themes that we've been talking about here today. So that's the question of what dynamism looks like and what the dynamist approach to making tech policy is. And we started on that with our Declaration of Internet Freedom, which is declarationofinternetfreedom.org. My next step is building on that, both on a small scale with explaining in a series of upcoming papers about privacy, how we can apply that that framework there, and that I've already explained. I think the FTC can do a lot better, but the same is true across many other areas of tech policy. I think you're going to see that same debate play out early next year about net neutrality and about the FCC. I mean, very briefly, the D.C. Circuit is likely to strike down the FCC's net neutrality regulations. Either way, whether they do or they don't, you're going to see a strong push for legislation next year to overhaul the FCC. We're well overdue for a new Communications Act, and I think what you're likely to see revived is the something like the Digital Age Communications Act that my former think tank, the Progress and Freedom Foundation, developed as a compromise proposal that brought together a wide range of people from the left and right, the tech policy world, to deal with net neutrality and other problems. And in essence, they essentially did that by making the FCC look more like the FTC, to replace the FCC's very vague so-called public interest standards with the more robust, economically grounded standard of consumer welfare. So that's going to be a project we're working on. It's something you're going to see in legislation. And I hope that this book, this what I'm calling for now, this book about dynamism and the dynamist framework, I hope that will provide a way of reorienting these conversations so that people like Frank and I can agree to disagree about, you know, how aggressive antitrust should be or what the standards should be, but we'll be within the general framework of first doing no harm and starting small.
Baron Zocca of Tech Freedom and co-editor of the book The Next Digital Decade, Essays on the Future of the Internet. Thank you much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. As I said in the introduction, I do commend this book. In fact, I am thinking about, I thought about it already, assigning it when I teach internet law, as I will, again in the spring. But I think it's a terrific compendium, and I think we will definitely continue this discussion. I'd love to have you back on the show. Thank you for joining us in the show and enlightening my listeners.
Well, thank you, and please follow me. I'm Baron Zocca on Twitter and Tech Freedom on Twitter. We can continue the conversation.
And when you sign up for Baron's feed, you'll find Hearsay Culture prominently there as well. As I mentioned in my introduction, I follow Baron's work and his organization's work closely. I'm excited to mention a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture, it's a good collection reflecting many of the interests that we've just talked about. Coming up next week is Professor Madhavi Sunder of UC Davis School of Law, author of the new book From Goods to a Good Life: Intellectual Property and Global Justice. Professor Chris Sprigman of Virginia Law, co-author of the book The Knockoff Economy. Professor Woodrow Hartzog of Cumberland School of Law at Samford, and Fred Stutzman of UNC on privacy and social media. Marcin D. Kaminsky and Stefan Larsson of Lund University on Pirate Bay and their work studying Pirate Bay in Sweden. And closing this quarter on KZSU's calendar, Professors Jeremy DeBeer and Chidi Aguamanam of the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law discussing the Open Air Project. I am in the process of beginning to explore guests for the unbelievably for the fall quarter of 2012, and so I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback on guests and the show, and any thoughts you have by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a couple of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. The first is live this quarter at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on Tuesdays on KZSU FM Stanford, or you can get the show via podcast by going to a number of places, either to hearsayculture.com, where you can pick up not only what the schedule is, but all 160-odd shows going back over 6 years now on Hearsay Culture. And you can also get other occasional commentary, although I blog very sporadically, as putting the show together and the podcast takes up more than enough time and gives me the opportunity to do the work I want to do there. But in addition, you can also get the show by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or you can subscribe to CIS's iTunes feed in the Apple store, where you can get not only Hearsay Culture, but any other events occurring at Stanford. As always, again, I do encourage encourage your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. You can also, as Baron mentioned, you can also follow Hearsay Culture on Twitter, or you can like the show on Facebook. But again, thank you for listening. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.